one of the things about our Constitution that makes it great is it's what we call a mixed Constitution. We have elements of rule by the one, rule by the few, and rule by the many, all combined in the Constitution. Rule by the one is our executive branch, rule by the few is our Supreme Court, and rule by the many is the Congress. Part of having a mixed Constitution, it gives stability to society. And part of having a mixed Constitution is a clear separation of powers. Here we have the Supreme Court sitting as a super legislature and ignoring the will of the people and taking Congress's power. If you look at Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution, it says that all legislative power shall be vested solely in the legislature, in the Congress. But this is an act of legislation. It's not an act of judgment.
Welcome to Think About It, a podcast from Houston Baptist University here in Houston, Texas. At HBU, we empower our students so their beliefs can fuel their lives. From our competitive nursing programs to our world-renowned theologians, we prepare our students to thrive at the university level and beyond. And now we join our host, Dr. Jerry Johnston, with today's guest.
We have a real treat today, and I want you to stay with us for the entire program. I mean, I really respect Dr. John Tyler, Jr., Program Coordinator for the Legal Studies and Associate Professor of Government, Houston Baptist University. Dr. Tyler practiced commercial, civil rights, and toxic tort litigation as an attorney in Texas for 35 years. And as a professor, Dr. Tyler's teaching emphasizes the dynamic conflict between the political, moral, and historical dimensions of law that formed the Western legal tradition. Welcome, Dr. Tyler.
It's great to be here.
Now, you've had a lot of experience in law. And I mean, you were a big shot before you ever got here.
Well, I always tell my students I was never really a big shot, but I was very fortunate to be surrounded by big shots. My career, it just happened that there were the golden age of litigation really in our country was really between about 1975 and 1995, 2000. We had three lawyers in Houston, Joe Reynolds, who was my law partner and my mentor, the only lawyer ever to be named a legend of the state bar by the State Bar of Texas. We had another man, Joe Jamail, and a third guy, John O'Quinn. I had a lot of cases with Joe Reynolds, with Joe Jamail. I had a lot of cases against John O'Quinn. Each of them were remarkably gifted. Reynolds was the greatest orator with juries that I've ever seen. Jamail, who greatest sense of humor, had a piercing, sarcastic sense of humor. So many stories I can tell friends, but I can't tell you here because he was not a very polished, polite guy. But he was absolutely devastating, and I learned from him that once you get your opponent gets the jury laughing at you, there's not a whole lot that you can do. And then John O'Quinn, who had some personal demons, and the state bar tried to disbar him twice, and he beat the bar both times.
Wow.
But he was the single greatest cross-examination attorney I've ever seen. So I was always surrounded for this whole period of time by these three men, either working with them or working against them. And I was very, very fortunate that way.
We are so honored that you're here at HBU. And how did that happen, just in brevity?
I was asked by a friend of a friend to fill in and teach the legal course in the MBA program here, and it was really grueling. It was a five-hour, once-a-week Saturday session teaching to the MBA students, and I found out that I really, really enjoyed it. I had one case in which I was grossly over-successful, way beyond any justice, and that kind of freed me to pursue what I wanted to pursue. And for many years, I had become very, very concerned with the direction that our jurisprudence was taking in our country.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that even though I had all this legal experience, I didn't really have the training to understand and to analyze what was going on. So I decided then to go ahead and get a PhD in philosophy, specializing in philosophy of government, philosophy of law. And once I did that, I felt that I had the mental toolkit to analyze what was going on. Love of teaching and a desire. I felt like I was particularly blessed. There had to be a reason for it, you know, that I could do what I wanted to do. I called Chris Hammonds up and said, you know, I'd like to take you to lunch. I took him to the Taste of Texas, which is the best restaurant
you
I know.
You can't go anywhere better than
trying
Taste
to manipulate
Texas.
Him.
If you're
going to
get anything done, you go to Taste of Texas.
Exactly. And we immediately hit it off, and I told him that I had an idea for some kind of an institute to focus on law and liberty and founding principles and things like that. He started laughing. He'd already gotten one pretty much established at HBU.
Which is the Center of Law and Liberty?
Right, today that he manages, or he's the director, rather. And I came in and was allowed to begin a pre-law program here. What I want to do the rest of my career is to raise up a generation of ethical and very capable attorneys that share a Christian worldview, because I think we're in a crisis point in our jurisprudence in our country right now. Other countries have had this crisis point as well. The historical parallels are really quite stunning. And in the company, we get to a point where either we're going to reform and restore our constitutional government, which is what I want to do. The Roman Republic with Cicero tried to do that, and he failed, and they lost the Republic. In England in the 17th century, they succeeded in restoring their constitutional government, and the people that led the way were Christian lawyers, and that's the model. So we're fast approaching a point now where we're either going to restore our jurisprudence the way that I think it should be, or we're going to transform into a different type of state and no longer be a democratic republic. And the Obergefell case is the latest example of the cases that indicate where we are.
Well, let's just bring it in right now since you did. Mm-hmm. You wrote in the Pillars magazine a 6 or 8 page article that just made waves everywhere. And in fact, it has 4 or 5 different parts to it, and it was on the Obergefell versus Hodge case that went before the U.S. Supreme Court when Scalia was still alive.
Correct.
And you might just, I want you to summarize Obergefell versus Hodges.
Okay.
What happened and what your assessment was.
We had about 28 states. There had been a number of ballot initiatives at this time across the country to define marriage as just between a man and a woman. So the Supreme Court took a case, and so in which some of these states' laws were challenged on constitutional grounds. So it presented a really fundamental question for our jurisprudence, which. Let me give you summarize what the case holding was, and then I'd like to, if it's okay with
yeah,
you,
no,
try to dissect in layman's language what the significance of this is. The most important thing about this is that the Supreme Court, for the first time in our history, actually said that we no longer should resolve our issues through democratic process. That issue, if it's what they call a fundamental issue, or if it's an issue that the Supreme Court claims it has an enhanced understanding of, then the Supreme Court should decide that just by themselves. So this violates every principle of our Constitution. And the way that they got to this decision was they had to redefine, create a whole new category of rights that they call fundamental rights. And they define it so loosely that it can almost include anything. But the important thing about it is that it was the new definition was the first time in Western jurisprudence that any type of standard like this had been used. In our jurisprudence, we had a doctrine of fundamental rights before this, which was, for instance, one fundamental right would be a parent can educate his or her child the way they want to. You can travel freely between the states without a passport, things like that. So the definition that had always stood for over 150 years in our jurisprudence was that a fundamental right was one that was historically deeply rooted in the country's culture and jurisprudence. Well, no nation before the United States had ever given full legal cognizance to gay marriage before. So obviously the old definition of fundamental right would not apply. So they redefined fundamental rights in such a way that it's something that just reflects intimate choices that help establish someone's identity. It's a really standard with no guidance whatsoever. And Justice Scalia said that these are the mystical aphorisms of a fortune cookie. That's what he called it with his wit, which is why I called the article The Fortune Cookie Court. But they're not a legal standard in that they give no guidance whatsoever. So two of our really, well, I just want to talk about three of our fundamental constitutional principles. The first one is consent of the governed. Since the Glorious Revolution in England, John Locke, it's been our adopted policy and philosophy that there is no legitimate source of governmental power except from the consent of the governed. Scalia's dissent in the case points out that this is a case that violates the consent of the governed. Every state that had addressed this issue had adopted a law or constitutional provision that refused to recognize gay marriage. And what the Supreme Court did then was just to ignore that. And in a 5-4 decision, they actually held that democratic processes have no role in America in determining an issue if they now decide that it's a fundamental right. The problem with this, of course, is the way they define fundamental right is so loose that almost anything can fit into it. I made the prediction in my class when this case came out that soon there would be other types of lawsuits. Judge Roberts said that there would be pluralist marriages that would be suing. I said that I thought that it would come first from a group called the North American Man-Boy Love Association, which is a group that advocates for removing criminal sanction from men who have sex with boys. And sure enough, 2 days after I made that prediction, the ACLU filed a lawsuit on their behalf. So this case ignores the consent of the governed. Another thing that it does is it ignores the separation of powers, which is a really fundamental aspect of our government. One of the things about our Constitution that makes it great is it's what we call a mixed Constitution. We have elements of rule by the one, rule by the few, and rule by the many all combined in the Constitution. Rule by the one is our executive branch, rule by the few is our Supreme Court, and rule by the many is the Congress. Part of having a mixed constitution, it gives stability to society. And part of having a mixed constitution is a clear separation of powers. Here we have the Supreme Court sitting as a super legislature and ignoring the will of the people and taking Congress's power. If you look at Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution, it says that all legislative power shall be vested solely in the legislature, in the Congress. But this is an act of legislation, it's not an act of judgment. And so what they did was to forcibly rewrite all of these laws as a group of just five people. In addition to this, another really crucial element of our Constitution is what we call federalism, where separation of powers splits powers vertically between the three branches of government. But federalism also splits power horizontally between the states and the federal government. So the way that our government is set up, the Constitution lists what we call enumerated powers for each branch of government. And the 10th Amendment says that only the powers that are listed are actually granted. The 10th Amendment then provides that all the other powers are reserved to the states and the people. So historically, just as fundamental rights had a very limited definition, the majority in this opinion, just 2 years earlier in the Windsor case in 2013, had ruled in a case that marriage laws are uniquely the sole province of the states, and the federal government has no business getting into it. And Scalia's dissent quotes Justice Kennedy's own language against him that contradicts their position that they took right here. So this case violates federalism, it violates separation of powers, and it also violates our most important principle, consent of the governed, which is our right to govern ourselves. Scalia pointed out that it's so inappropriate for the court to do this because there was no one on the United States Supreme Court at that time or today that is either a Protestant or an evangelical, and that's the majority of the religious views in the United States. There's no one who has not gone to law school, either at Harvard or at Yale. This is hardly a representative group trying to decide how 330 million people have to live their lives. So the most troubling statement in here, though, is when it says that democratic processes are of no moment, democratic processes are inappropriate, and democratic processes are unnecessary if the Supreme Court feels that it has an enhanced understanding of an issue. And that's a very troubling development. In fact, it could not be more troubling for me as a believer in our Constitution.
So, I mean, when you have the opportunity to read through this, and you can go to hbu.edu and put in Pillars, and the digital copy of this, October 2015, is on here. I mean, let's break this down. Five jurists decided on redefining marriage.
Correct.
For the entire nation.
Correct. And nullified state constitutions and state statutes, all of which had been validly ratified and passed by the people who elected their representatives and state legislatures, and a governor, and all these branches signed off on it.
And that was about 28 states, or was it 20?
About that number, yeah.
So 29 states who had gone through the legislative process to amend their state constitution.
Right.
And to make sure that marriage was defined as a man and a woman, were in that June decree nullified.
Exactly right. And the Supreme Court also indicated that in the future, it more or less reserves the right to do that whenever it wants to. But here's the problem. A legal system should be predictable. And that's one of the many qualities that we want. It's impossible now to predict what the Supreme Court will do because the standard is so, for lack of a better word, loosey-goosey and so all-inclusive that anything that the justices want to fit into these definitions of fundamental right will now be a fundamental right. Where do we find that? The only place that we can find that is in the private judgment of these five individuals. And there's nothing that keeps them from changing today or tomorrow, just like they did with this issue in just 2 years in the Windsor case, in which they said only the states can make marriage laws. Now they say only the Supreme Court.
And so they effectively reversed their decision of 2013.
That's a euphemism. They flip-flopped.
Yes.
It's complete 180
degrees. Well,
I've
heard of flip-flopping. Politicians are known for that.
Right.
Now, I mean, presidents come and go, as we both know, and there's all kinds of things on that. But the court and the appointment of the court has repercussions beyond a decade, certainly beyond a president, even two terms.
That's a wonderful observation. Wonderful
and
observation.
So we have Ms. Ginsburg here, who's hanging on by a thread at 85, who has cancer, it's amazing she's hung on this long. And you have the appointment of Gorsuch. And so is it conceivable that there could be one or two more appointments to the court in the next 2 to 4, 6 years?
Yes, it is. And although I'm opposed to many of the liberal judges' points of view, I of course do not want to hasten their death in any way.
Right.
The fundamental issue, could I just address the issue of judicial review and the court's power?
Yes.
Because that's really the fundamental issue facing our republic today. When our government was founded, a man named Sir William Blackstone, who wrote the greatest book of jurisprudence ever written, for a lot of technical reasons I won't go into now, but he wrote a book called Commentaries on the Laws of England. It's in four volumes, 1765 to 1769. His work on common law was adopted in many states as the official statement of the common law. And the reason I want to focus on that is that he had a very strong view of the judge's role in society. It was called the declaratory theory of law. It's really passed on from Matthew Hale, who preceded him. But the declaratory theory of law is often stated, judges never make law, they only find law. And the reason for that is that judges are not representative of the people. So when the ratification of the Constitution was an issue, the issue came up of whether we should have lifetime appointment for Supreme Court justices. And the person who really pushed for that was Alexander Hamilton, who of course is very popular with the musical now.
Mm-hmm.
But
one
of the aspects of Hamilton, and it's very easy, I do not mean to demean Hamilton in any way. He's a giant. But one of the things about Hamilton, he was the illegitimate son of a Scottish lord, and he was basically in his heart an aristocrat and a monarchist. So he wanted life terms for the president. He wanted life terms for all senators, and he wanted life terms for the judges on the Supreme Court. Fortunately, we defeated two, the Anti-Federalists defeated two of the three, but the judges were appointed for life, and that went through. So one of the people who, if my students are watching this, they know this guy coming and going. There was a man who was one of the Anti-Federalists that was critical of the Constitution that came out of the Constitutional Convention. The main, and he was an Anti-Federalist, his name was Judge Robert Yates, and he wrote under the pen name of Brutus. And he wrote Anti-Federalist papers at the same time the Federalist papers were written primarily by Madison and Hamilton and also John Jay. What he said in there is that this lifetime appointment of judges is a really, really bad idea. And so the first half of my Con Law 1 course that I teach is we go to his papers and he makes four predictions. And every prediction has come true. The first prediction that he made was that the Supreme Court would ignore or evade the text of the Constitution. And that's exactly what they did. The second thing he said they would do is that they would increase their own jurisdiction so that they could increase their own power. And that, of course, is the case of Marbury versus Madison, where they gave themselves the power of judicial review. Now, the power of judicial review was debated during ratification, and it was not included in the Constitution. Justice Marshall gave it to the Supreme Court, and we've allowed the Supreme Court to keep it. Now, what does power of judicial review say? It says that in the first case, Marbury versus Madison, the Supreme Court can grade the papers of the President and Congress and overrule anything they do. In the second case that was important a couple of years later, a case named Fletcher versus Peck, he held the Supreme Court could ignore the 10th Amendment and violate what state governors and state legislatures do. And then in the last case, Martin versus Hunter's lessee, he said the Supreme Court can overrule state court judgments. In other words, within about 20 years, Marshall had given the Supreme Court power over every aspect of political life in the United States. So he's very much an imperialist kind of emperor guy. Now, his main justification for judicial review is that he had taken a judicial oath to protect, defend the Constitution from all enemies, foreign and domestic. Well, every soldier, sailor, airman in our country takes that same oath. Mm-hmm. I took the same oath in November 1978 when I was sworn in as a lawyer. That oath does not give me the power of judicial review, and it didn't give Marshall the power of judicial review either. And one of the cases that we study in my courses, there's a Pennsylvania case called Eakin versus Robb, which I think is about 1830, in which the judge on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court takes Marshall to task and eviscerates every argument that Marshall gave for judicial review. And I was reminded of this by what you said, because this is what he says. He said, when the Supreme Court passes a judgment, and a lot of people don't understand this, after 30 days when that judgment becomes final, you know, the Supreme Court can't even go back and change it. Mm. Once that judgment is in there and that opinion becomes final, it's there forever. It is forever. And it's almost impossible for the Supreme Court to ever change its mind on things. Now, they do it all the time, but look at what it does to our legal system. It destroys predictability. It destroys equal protection. Every decision that they do that is an ex post facto decision, violates due process. Every tenet of our jurisprudence is violated when you go in and do that. So this case, the third thing that Brutus said would happen with the Supreme Court is that they would increase the power of the Congress. So just one example there is the case of Wickard versus Filburn at the end of World War II. Congress has a power of interstate commerce, but that case extends the power of Congress over activities that are neither interstate nor commerce. In that case, a man in Ohio grew wheat with his own seed, harvested it himself, made it into flour himself, baked it in his own kitchen, his own bread, and ate it himself. Nothing was involved, nothing was bought or sold, nothing went into across the state line. But yet the Supreme Court held in that case that that was interstate commerce. As a consequence of that, then, Congress has almost complete jurisdiction over anything they want, despite the 10th Amendment. The fourth thing that he said would happen is that the Supreme Court would then start attacking the ability of the individual states to make any viable laws or to enforce them themselves. And that's what's happened. There have been three great jumps that the Supreme Court's done that. The first was trying to enforce the 14th Amendment on the states. If you go to the enabling clause of the 14th Amendment, one of the Civil War amendments, it has the due process and equal protection clauses. But those amendments only apply to the states, not to the federal government. And the enabling clause says specifically that only Congress has the right to enforce the 14th Amendment. And cases for 100 years from the Supreme Court said Congress has no power, I mean, the Supreme Court has no power to enforce the 14th Amendment on the states. Until 1962, in a case called Baker versus Carr, the one man, one vote case, when they reversed exactly the same facts from a case 14 years earlier called Colgrove versus Green. They completely flip-flopped on that case. So at this point now, three of Brutus's predictions have come true. Congress now has unlimited power over the country through the Interstate Commerce Clause, and now the Supreme Court, which generally has jurisdiction over only federal issues, now has taken control over the states as well through the 14th Amendment. The next step was the so-called implied right of privacy that led to Roe v. Wade. This is a really bad incident where judges read a philosophical book and borrowed a bad idea. The case that originally applied this, I hope this isn't too tedious.
No, perfect.
Okay. The case that really applied it was a case called Connecticut versus Griswold, where Planned Parenthood sued to try to overturn Connecticut statutes regulating birth control. And the judge in that case had just read a book that had come out a year earlier from an Oxford law professor named H.L.A. Hart. The name of the book is The Concept of Law. And in that book, he said, contrary to the declaratory theory of law that judges never make law, they only find the law, what he says is judges should make law in every case. The reason is they're unclear. Legal terms are unclear. And the judge has to redefine legal terms in every case. Well, my view is hogwash. We have contracts and we have constitution in writing, and I know what it means when I read it. But activist judges and activist law professors who failed through democratic methods to achieve their political agendas, they embrace this new philosophy. It's not new. It was really from the sophists in the 7th century BC, but it's packaged. They adopt that, and then that was the beginning of the implied private right of action, in which the case admits that there's no right of privacy in the Bill of Rights. It was never intended to be in the Bill of Rights, but we find it in the penumbra or the shadows of other rights. Therefore, we are going to create a new right of privacy and overturn the Connecticut statutes. And then, of course, that was used in Roe v. Wade. And today, since we've legalized abortion, we now abort more than two babies, twice the number of babies every year, as have died in all of our wars put together. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal last week in the latest numbers. There are actually, in New York City, there were 29,000 abortions of black babies and only 23,000 live births. So that's the implied right of privacy. So I thought that the Supreme Court had gone as far as it could. But then when the Obergefell case came in, we had a new doctrine of fundamental rights. And it's really just to understand, I try to teach my students to go beyond just the superficial reading of the case and what the justices say and see what's really at play there. And what's really going on here is fundamental rights is a legal device that they will now use to overturn any state law anytime they want to. All they have to do is get five judges to agree.
It is a scary thing to realize, and it shows you how important it is for us to pray for the Supreme Court. My
Absolutely.
Wife and I do. We pray for the Joint Chiefs, and we pray for the President, we pray for the House and the Senate, and we do it regularly. But let me ask you this. So with Gorsuch appointed, are we at a stalemate? On the Supreme Court,
we're really at 4-4-1.
4-4-1. So the wild card is
Kennedy.
Yes.
Yeah. And so the reason for this is four of the judges follow this judicial philosophy called legal positivism that H.L.A. Hart had. Mm-hmm. Almost all of our law schools teach that. And notice again, the whole point of that philosophy is to try to run an end run around democratic processes. Sure. Okay? The judges, in this case, the gay marriage initiative had failed almost everywhere that it had tried and been rejected by the people. But if you accept this philosophy that judges can make new law in every case and we're not bound by the Constitution, then that allows them to do whatever they want to do. But this is a real problem. I've got to mention the most fundamental principle of government, and that's the sovereignty of law. Mm-hmm. So we go back to ancient Athens, and all my courses begin with Athens and the Roman Republic and then England, 17th century. Ancient Athens, at the end of the Peloponnesian War, in a 10-year period, they had 6 different revolutions. And then Socrates was judicially murdered at this time. So Plato, who was Socrates' student, and Aristotle, who was Plato's student, both suffered under the Athenian rule, and their primary purpose of their philosophy was to try to figure out what is it that we need to maintain a stable society. And both of them came to the same conclusion, which was that law has to be sovereign. So Plato says in the Laws that the sovereignty of law, which means laws wield supremacy over political rulers are bound by the law, and political rulers have to enforce the law. So the sovereignty of law over that gives us a government of laws, not a government of men, is the single most important factor that will predict the destruction or the preservation of a society. Mm-hmm. Then Aristotle in the Politics has a very famous passage that all my students are forced to memorize, which is, in discussing whether we're better to have a government of laws or government of men, he says that in the end, the final decision has to be that well-formulated laws must be the final sovereign. And he gives a great explanation. He says that man beset by passion is the worst of all creatures, and that even the best among us are beset by passion from time to time. Mm-hmm. Law, on the other hand, is reason without passion. Therefore, we have to go with sovereign laws as opposed to sovereign tyrannical individuals. And that's our most fundamental principle adapted all through the Constitution and all through our legal system. But when you have judges then that have this doctrine of fundamental rights, that completely destroys the sovereignty of law in our society. And if you don't have that, then you don't have a legal system. And although I may be prejudiced as a law professor, without a legal system, you don't have a stable society. And once that is reached, then we revert back to a state of nature in which nothing that's valuable can really be obtained.
This article is available, and we're going to attach a link to it with Dr. Tyler's interview today. And you need to take the time to read it. It's stunning, and it's entitled The Fortune Cookie Court by Dr. John O. Tyler, Ph.D., board certified in civil trial law, and the professor for legal studies, associate professor for government at HBU. Now you can check out Dr. Tyler through hbu.edu. You can visit hbu.edu humanities. And just before we close, I want you to just comment briefly on, we've heard so much about the FISA court. Mm. And this is a poll by me, myself, and I. If you polled Americans and asked them what the FISA court was, I got to believe 8 out of 10 would say, I don't know what you're talking about. And yet this FISA court and what has happened in recent months has incredible consequences.
It really does. The FISA court was established as a secret court, which should give us pause. The last really secret court that we had in the English tradition was the Court of the Star Chamber, which was basically a torture chamber where the Stuart and Tudor kings tortured their political enemies. And that was modeled on the Inquisition in Europe that was used on, I teach the trial of Galileo here. It's a secret court, and it's only supposed to authorize surveillance on terrorists. Now, the Fourth Amendment requires, before an American citizen can be spied upon or have a search warrant issued against them, a lot of specific requirements that there has to be probable cause, which is reasonable belief that a crime is being committed or has been committed, that's currently going on. It has to be pursuant to a warrant granted by a judge based on an affidavit that is sworn, based on personal knowledge and given under penalty of perjury. That is not the standard in the FISA court. Because the FISA court was originally intended to deal with non-American citizens, it's a much lower standard of suspicion, which is the same standard that the Inquisition used, by the way. And then the way that the game has been played is that you get the judge, who only hears from one side, okay, to authorize this warrant. And then if the prosecutor suspects that there may be some type of terrorist connection, then they are ignoring the Fourth Amendment and surveilling American citizens in violation of their constitutional rights. And the allegations are, and it may well be true, that the politicized law enforcement agencies of our government actually spied on one of our two major candidates for president during his presidential campaign when his opponent was favored by that politicized law enforcement administration. So this is a complete violation of constitutional rights. And
that sounds like Russia.
Well, it's exactly, in some regards, exactly like Russia was. Now, the other thing about this is, I teach a great trials course where we compare legal systems, and the ancient Israel had by law that their trials could only be Tuesday through Thursday in one spot in the Sanhedrin, open to the public, because when the public is not there, then the judges are not accountable. Mm-hmm. And once judges are not accountable, then they tend to do what they want to do. The same thing that we have. Brutus was saying we shouldn't have life terms for the Supreme Court. And his wording is, once somebody has life term as a judge, he forgets that there's a difference between man and God. And he begins to treat the laws as his personal private property with which he can do what he wants to do. And that, to a large degree, explains where we are. Human beings are all fallen. We all have feet of clay, and therefore, we've learned from history that we need to base all of our political power on the consent of the governed and not on a group of people who manage to get a particular political position.
Thank you, Dr. John Tyler. And now you know why the professor of government at HBU, you have a tremendous opportunity, the Center of Law and Liberty at HBU with Professor Hammonds. What a gift you are to our university, and we're grateful that you came today to spend time with us.
Thank you. It's a real privilege to get to teach here.
HBU.edu/humanities, Dr. John Tyler, Jr. Check him out, and thank you, and we'll be talking to you again.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Here at HBU, we influence the culture around us by challenging our students to put their beliefs into action every day.